why should I have to hide who I am? I wouldn't expect somebody who's Muslim to not wear a hijab, right? The name of your podcast is Here I Am.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidi.
My guest today is someone whose name you might not recognize, but everyone should know. I don't want to give people any clues about what's coming in the episode, so I just want them to listen. I'll tell them this. My guest today is an everyday hero. And I know you're already shaking your head, saying, no, I'm not. But let's dig into this. I am very excited to have you here. So here I am with Sam Fried. Sam Simcha Fried. That's your Jewish name. Sam, I begin every episode with the same question. What kind of a Jew are you?
First of all, congratulations on season 3.
Thank you so much.
Super, super exciting, and hopefully many, many, many more seasons, and it's an honor to be here. What kind of Jew am I? What I always tell people is that I feel that I'm the fighting Jew, right? I feel that I was born to fight, and that spans beyond just the physical battlefield, right? Beyond even the ideological battlefield. I think the way that I feel as a religious Jew, mind you, I don't know if people could see, but I wear a kippah, I wear a tzitzit, I daven every day. I feel that being somebody who's on all these different battlefields, I'm constantly fighting for the identity of the Jewish people and the continuity of the Jewish people. And it's something that I'm super proud of. And that goes back to my grandfather who fought on Normandy Beach and on Omaha Beach in 1944 to help eradicate the Nazis and what they were doing to the Jewish people then. And even goes back to the Maccabees who were fighting for the Jewish people. And so as an IDF soldier fighting, I think a lot of Jews today feel like the only way that they can really fight is to physically fight. But it's not the case at all, right? I've been gone from the war for 8 months now, 9 months.
And we'll get to the different battlefields because you've had multiple battlefields. But before we get to those, I want to ask you, have you always been the fighter Jew?
I like to think so. I mean, look, growing up, it's easy to say.
You were born and raised in Queens, New York.
Yeah.
Right? That's, I think, the first thing. An American native Jew. Yeah. What was it like being Jewish in Queens as a kid, teenager? Were there any fights that you had to fight?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. I think, growing up, I grew up in a very religious area and, I was masorti, like I was Shomer Shabbat, Shomer Kashrut. And I think going to yeshiva growing up, I felt like I had very strong Jewish ideals and values. But I didn't really experience any anti-Semitism because everybody in my school was Jewish until I got to high school. And I went to Ramaz for high school, and you might be asking, how did you experience anti-Semitism there?
But, just as for people who are listening or don't know, Ramaz is like a very prestigious and incredible school in the Upper East Side, modern Orthodox Jewish school.
Yeah, so I was on the subway after school one day, and I vividly remember, I used to wear like tzitzit out, kippah on the subway, and I remember 14, 15 years old. I was like a small kid. I wasn't this like 6'2 guy that I am now. And I remember I was on the subway. It was crowded in the middle of the winter. And it's really cold and really, really stuffy. And the subway stopped short and I accidentally stepped on this guy's foot. Mind you, I'm a 15, 14 year old.
And it happens in New York City every day.
Every single day.
100 times a day.
Yeah. And I'm by myself. And, this guy like looks at me. Immediately sees the kippah on my head, sees my tzitzit sticking out, and starts going on a rampage cursing at me, like calling me a dirty Jew, calling me, I'm not going to say the curses that he said, but I immediately start bawling my eyes out, like, what is going on? I've never experienced this before, and nobody came to my aid. And I was like...
Wait, so this is a packed subway train, middle of the day, I assume you're going back from school, you're 15. Mm-hmm. The reason I want to emphasize the story because I don't think people sometimes they hear these stories and they kind of like glance over. But you're 15 years old. You're visibly Jewish. You made a mistake like everyone does sometimes. Yeah. You accidentally stepped on someone. They go on an anti-Semitic rant. And then what happens? People...
Nothing. Everybody's just staring, watching me crying. And I mean, I didn't know how to react. This is my first experience with anti-Semitism in my entire life. And it's not like I didn't know that there was anti-Semitism. At 14, 15, you know that there's stuff. Obviously, this is before the war. This is before, I guess at that time, it was even before Tzuk Eitan, right? It was before social media was as big as it is now. And I felt so vulnerable to what I feel is like this Jewish innate sensation of like, wow, people are out to get me. You hear about it, you know about it, but you don't know it until you feel it. And that was my first time feeling it. And I was kind of like, looking back on it now, how could nobody say a word when you visibly see a kid getting verbally assaulted by somebody else? And I mean, after that, I took my kippah off, I took my tzitzit off, and I stopped wearing them on the subway. And I was like, I don't feel confident that I can be me, because at that time I was so innocent. I didn't know that like somebody could even conceivably yell at a kid and call him a dirty Jew and curse at him for being Jewish, for accidentally stepping on him on the subway. And it was only until after the army did I say, no, screw that. Dafka, because that happened, I have to wear my kippah on the subway now. Dafka, because that happened, I have to be the strong Jew that if I see, not just against Jews, if I see anybody facing some type of verbal attack on the subway or in public, I want to be the person who's standing up for that person because somebody didn't stand up for me.
So yeah, let me ask you this, because I didn't grow up here. And growing up in Israel, there's a lot of things that you deal with, things that are not normal. Being called a dirty kike is not one of them. In your experience, just living here, was that a unique experience, or is that something that happened to your friends? Like when you told your friends at school, your parents, your cousins, what was their reaction?
Honestly, looking back on it, I don't even think I told anybody. I was so ashamed and so fearful. I don't even think I processed it until later that it was like this like attack against my identity, right? I didn't view it as like something like that. I was like, oh, like this is just something that happened. And then like obviously my actions of taking my kippah off and being fearful subconsciously kind of came from that. But something that's interesting that you said growing up in Israel for you is, and this is something that I explained to my teammates in the army, is that I think one of the biggest differences between Israelis and Jews in the diaspora is that Israeli Jews often feel like it's the world against Israel. Whereas in America, yes, we understand there's a war against Israel and Israel's existence, but we feel that the underlying tone there is inherently anti-Semitic. Israelis don't really understand what this idea of anti-Semitism is necessarily, right? Because it's so focused against Israel all the time. So when I was explaining to my friends during Shomer HaChomot, in Operation Guardian of the Walls in May of 21, where Joey Borgen was attacked in the street, and Joey's family and I go way back, I was like,
by the way, I should say Joey Borgen is an American Jew, was attacked in the street of New York 2021 by Within Our Lifetime. So Within Our Lifetime is a hate group. They had a protest in May 2021, and then seven, I think, of its members were texting, let's find a Jew, let's go on a Jew hunt, which we then later saw in Amsterdam a few years later. And they really, if you look at the pictures, beat him to pulp.
Yeah, I mean, neck brace and everything. And so when I was telling my friends that that's kind of what's happening in New York City, we're talking in Manhattan, we're not talking in some random place in Arkansas or whatever, you're talking Manhattan with 2 million Jews in New York State. Like, this is the reality of what diaspora looks like for Jews, where people are targeting Jewish stores, where people are targeting visibly Jewish people. And my friends are like, Chi, mata omer? Azov, saying like, what are you saying? What are you talking about? And I'm like, no, you guys don't get it. People hate us. They hate us because of our blood. No different than they've hated us throughout history. No different.
But let me play devil's advocate, which is, people might be watching or listening would say, look, well, you hid your kippah, you hid your tzitzit, and you're safe. Like, what's the big deal? Like, no one hates you because of your blood. You're just like, you just be like everyone else. Don't stick out. Like, what would you say to that?
I mean, I love you, but that's the most ridiculous thing in the entire world, right? Why should I have to hide who I am when I wouldn't expect somebody who's Muslim to not wear a hijab? I wouldn't expect a black person to wear white face. I don't want to have to hide who I am. Why should I? Right? The name of your podcast is Here I Am. I am proud to be Jewish.
Right.
I deserve to be Jewish, not because of me. What are my merits that I deserve to be Jewish? No, I deserve to be Jewish because of the millions of people who had to die because they were Jewish, because they didn't have a chance to fight. They didn't have the opportunity to wear a kippah in public and be proud about it. You know what they had? They had to wear a yellow star. They didn't have the opportunity to put the kippah in the pocket and say, okay, like, I can hide. They couldn't hide. So who the hell am I to say that, okay, I can hide? I'm done. We're done with that. That time is over.
That's very true. And I will take it even a step forward and say, I've heard this argument, which I think is a very compelling argument. The Jews that are hiding are making it more difficult for the Jews that aren't.
Without a doubt.
Because there is power in numbers. And if in a group of 1,000 Jews, only 100 are visible, they will be targeted. But if all 1,000 Jews would be visible, we won't be targeted because we will be there on the streets and people will see us.
I think even beyond that, and you're absolutely right, but I think beyond that, there's this idea that if you have most of the Jews who simply are like, okay, well, we can hide because we can take the kippot off, or we can just say we're against Israel and people won't come and get us. They don't understand what the actual problem is, right? Before Israel existed, people still hated Jews. The Holocaust happened. Israel didn't exist, right? I mean, before that, Spanish Inquisition, Israel didn't exist. People hate Jews because people hate Jews. There's no real justification for it. And so if you think that you can hide, you're missing the whole point. This is baseless hatred.
Right.
It's baseless. It's not like rationale works here where like you can hide. No, Hitler said he wanted to kill Jews if even a percentage of their blood was Jewish because it's already tainted.
It's the same, by the way, it's the same with race laws that used to be in the United States.
Exactly.
And nobody was asking, why are people racist? They were saying, as they should, racism is bad, period. Let's eradicate
get rid of
it.
Yeah.
So you born and raised in Queens, New York, went to Ramaz, then went to City College.
Baruch, yeah.
Baruch, right. What did you major in, by the
Finance.
Way? Finance. 2020, you graduate, you're 22. Then what?
So my dream since I was 9 years old was to join the IDF and be in Sanhanim and paratroopers. And that kind of came from kind of like what I mentioned earlier, that my grandfather fought in World War II to protect Jews in the world. And I felt very similarly that I wanted to do something bigger than myself before I started my professional career, where I feel like people's lives are generally defined by specific moments or specific periods, right? And I wanted to feel like even if I work for the next 50 years, 60 years, and do nothing significant, at least I could be defined by the fact that I did something bigger than myself for the Jewish people. I did something bigger than myself in protecting the Jewish people so that maybe I live under a bridge somewhere, but my grandkids and kids could say, he fought for us.
Yeah, but Sam, let's be fair. You could have done a lot of things that are good for the Jewish people, fight for the Jewish people. You could have done it here from the comfort of your home. I don't know where you live. I assume it's somewhat comfortable. You could have gone to Israel and volunteered with Magen David Adom, like the Jewish version of Red Cross. Red Cross, we know, doesn't care about Jews. So it's, you know, we have our own thing.
Yeah.
You could have done it as a firefighter in Israel in the police. Why join the IDF? You literally put your life in risk. Why that?
It's a good question. I think in the end of the day, like I said, I'm a born fighter, and not because I want to fight. There's zero part of me that wants to fight. There's zero part of me that wanted to go back for this war. Zero part of me. I wish I didn't have to. But I also know that it would be so hypocritical of me to live my life thinking, okay, I could just pray and you know, thank the soldiers and pray that they're okay and hope that Israel is somehow just going to be fine on its own. Israel wasn't built by Israelis necessarily. They were built by people who came after the Shoah and had to fight for their lives with zero understanding of what would come from Israel, right? In 1948, when we fought against 7 neighboring Arab armies, there was no guarantee that Israel was going to exist the next day. The next day, it could have fallen apart. And yet people still, 15-year-olds, there's stories of people who didn't even speak the language, who just took arms and said, I have no family left. Everybody's been killed already. This is our last hope. And so for me, it feels like, you know, we say the Hatikva, which literally, our national anthem, which literally means the hope. And what I tell people is that it's not just an anthem, right? It's not just a song. It's an obligation. We have to be the hope. How can I live my whole life telling my kids and my grandkids and my family members and my friends that we love this country, Israel, and this is our home, but I'm not willing to fight for my home when it's in trouble?
So tell me about your experiences, you know, joining the IDF. I'm sure, like, no matter how much you feel like you're a natural born fighter, and your grandfather's story, which is just incredible, I'm sure it was difficult.
Yeah.
Coming from New York City to, I don't know where, you know, Basit Sanhanim, I don't know where it was.
Yeah, Bacht Sanhanim.
Bacht Sanhanim. Like, what was it like?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the context of when I drafted was also a very strange time for the world, right? It was March of 2020, so the very beginning of COVID, which was in a lot of ways good for me having drafted at that time, in a lot of ways just different. The good thing is I didn't really miss much in the world, right, for during the time of my Army service, so I didn't feel like I was missing out. But it was just strange in general, and being in a new place where you don't have the comfort of being able to even express yourself, at least at the beginning, express yourself the way that you want to, and the frustration that comes with that, and having to excel at a language that you're not native to and understand a culture of people that you're not native to. And as much as I've visited Israel, it's very different to be, you know, fast-paced environment where there's no like leeway where they're like, oh, okay, like he's a lone soldier, give him a break. No, it's, I expect that Dafka for me, because I'm 22 and a little bit more of a responsible individual than an 18-year-old that just drafted, that I would be leading people. And how can I lead people if I'm falling behind in the language? So I think that was probably at the beginning my biggest concern. Of course, I did everything in my power to kind of make sure that wouldn't be an issue. And so that was just learning the language as fast as possible and as efficiently as possible. And then just being in the misgeret of the army, right? Being in the framework of the army is just so different, right? Months before, I'm partying, enjoying life in Manhattan, at bars, at clubs, whatever. And then suddenly, it's 3 a.m. and you're running a 10K and like you're doing whatever in the field. You're training like crazy and you have tanks next to you and it's just like, what, am I in a movie? What's going on here? Like, my friend and I, another lone soldier who was in my company, we'd always say, like, no matter what's happening, how bad it is, getting rained on for kilometers and kilometers, carrying heavy equipment or whatever, we just look at each other and we're like, it's part of the movie script. It's just, this is like, we're living a crazy life right now.
But in a way, it's not a movie script. It's real life.
It's so real.
I want to ask you, was there anything during those 2-3 years where you were serving in the IDF that shattered your previous misconceptions? And you seem like you knew a lot about Israel and what was going on and the whole like issue with Palestinians and with Hamas, make a differentiation there, West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon. Was there something that shattered your preconceptions?
Yeah, I mean, so many different things. Obviously, I think first and foremost, the love of the Israeli people for their homeland. Like, man, people love Israel so much. And it's not, when I say Israel, I don't mean necessarily just like the Jews in Israel, right? Like on my team, I had Arabs serving with me. And they love Israel just the same, right? And I didn't know if I really expected that to be the case. But they were fighting with us in the war. They were fighting with us during missions just the same as we were, right? And so that's one. Two, and I guess kind of...
By the way, and I think that's an important thing because for people to understand, Arab Israelis, vast majority of them feel like they are an important partner in this venture.
Immensely.
In the Israeli, you know, state. And to you and I, that maybe doesn't come as a surprise.
Yeah.
But for people that have been fed lies about apartheid and about ethnic cleansing, like people have been told this very twisted story. When they are faced with someone like that, when they're faced with Yosef Haddad, who is an Arab Christian Israeli who was severely injured in the 2006 war in Lebanon, like they don't even know what to do with that.
Yeah, yeah, because that doesn't meet the narrative, right? No. It's that we're subjugating every single Arab in Israel to them. And it's just simply not the case. These people are among the most Zionistic people that I know. Right. And we're willing and still willing to die for Israel. And by the way, I think it's super important for people to understand is that when Iran is shooting 300 ballistic missiles and the Houthis are shooting UAVs and Hamas and Hezbollah are shooting rockets into Israel, they're not saying, okay, we're targeting specifically Jewish people. They're targeting Muslims, they're targeting Christians, they're targeting Jews, they're targeting anybody. And when these terrorist attacks happen, they aren't specifically targeting Jews. It's Muslims as well. On October 7th, Muslims were killed. This isn't like a... What I always say is that this isn't a war inherently just Jew against Muslim or Palestinian against Israeli. This is inhumanity versus humanity. We protect, as an IDF soldier, my job is to protect people. I don't care what your religion is. I don't care who you are. I don't care who you serve. My job is to protect you as an innocent civilian. That includes Palestinians. I'm ready and willing to die for Palestinians just like I am for Jews. Just like I am for Israelis. It does not matter to me. Innocent people are innocent people. It's that simple. But to your question, I think another really interesting thing that people maybe don't understand, and this is a huge talking point about the war specifically, is, you know, Israel's failure on October 7th. So when I served in, I guess I was on the Gaza border June to November of 2021, the way that it worked was we, if it was 3 a.m. and somebody was maybe 400 meters from the fence, the first fence, right? Mm-hmm. We would get an alert and we would be there sub 1 minute. We're there at 3 a.m. because somebody is 400 meters away from the fence. And so people say all the time, like, how is it possible that Israel wasn't prepared? They weren't able to stop them before. No, there had to have been some massive, massive breach of security that disabled them from being able to get there. From whether it was a cyber attack, and look, who am I to speculate? I'm just a soldier. I'm not high up in intelligence or anything. But to me, what seems like happened is there was likely a major cyber attack with the help of some foreign country, not going to implicate any countries, but they could not pull this off.
Well, we don't need to speculate, and this is important, but we don't speculate too much. But we do know that the attacks of October 7 started by they first targeted the cameras, the electric equipment that was monitoring the borders.
Yeah.
And it is a border, just like every country has a border.
Absolutely.
Targeting the units that are specific to what we call the tetspiniot, the observers, that are specific to that. And then once you take off the eyes and the ears, then it's hard to mobilize people because you don't know where the attack is coming.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that because then you get discharged in 2022.
Yep.
You came back to the US. Why didn't you stay in Israel?
Listen, that was, I made a deal with my parents that I'd come back, and I'm happy I came back. I think it was the right thing for me at the time, but inevitably my goal was to be in Israel.
So you came back. What did you do?
Took some time to myself to kind of reintegrate into society. It was quite a jump to come back into a regular life. But after a little bit of time, I was like, okay, prepared to now start my career, start working at a bank in project finance. And then I guess after a bit of time working there, the war breaks out.
So let's get to the war. October 7th, where were you?
Yeah, so I was in the city. I was by one of my friends celebrating the holiday, Simchat Torah. And another one of my friends who was in the army with me, he was in the same battalion as me in Sanchanim, just the draft class after me. And we were out late the night before, got back. I guess at the time that we had gotten back at like 3 a.m, things had already begun. But because we're both observant, we didn't know. Then at like around 7 a.m, our friend who isn't observant woke us up saying like, guys, something crazy is going on in Israel.
Just to be clear for people who are following this and might not be sure on this, being an observant Jew on Shabbat, Saturday, and on a Chag, a holiday, you don't use your phone, you don't use TV. So you're disconnected from the world.
Yeah.
So you have this, which is, by the way, a beautiful experience to be disconnected once a week from the
100%.
World. And then your friend tells you what? Something's happening?
Yeah, he says like, guys, Israel's at war, right? And we're hungover and we're tired and it's 7 a.m. on like a Saturday, right? We don't know what's going on. And the way I explain it to people is like when somebody who isn't in the army says to you like, oh, Israel's at war, as a soldier, you don't immediately think, okay, Israel's actually at war. Right. You think, okay, this is like a civilian who doesn't really understand how things work necessarily, right? Because when I was in my service in May of 21, 4,500 rockets were shot into Israel over the span of 11 days and we didn't go into Gaza, right? And so I'm thinking, okay, probably maybe a terrorist attack, maybe unfortunately a bunch of people killed. It doesn't necessarily mean we're at a full-scale war, maybe a bunch of rockets, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a war. Then obviously he throws on the TV and shows us Kilo what's going on.
Which is, by the way, something that I've been talking about, you know, with people almost as a side note, like an afterthought, that Israel is, to my knowledge, the only country where hundreds or thousands of rockets can be shot onto the center of the country and people would be like, yeah, okay. Again.
It's not like, an act of war.
It's not an act of war. It's just life.
Yeah.
That is something that, on the one hand, is incredible. Like, how strong are the Israeli people and the Jewish diaspora to take that and say, you know what? That we're stronger than that. We keep going. And on the other hand, like, that is a problem. The world doesn't understand what it's like when it's routine to be shot at.
It's more than a problem. It's sad, right? In the end of the day, that is probably as a result of, you know, international coverage and sympathy with the other side. But the way that I ask people is, if one ballistic missile from any country in the world was shot towards the United States, even if it missed, what would happen? One ballistic missile. We would be in, that country would be
obliterated.
Yeah. There would be a big problem for that country.
And I'll tell you even more. The government would find a way to stop these pro-terror protests in New York City and in
LA. If somebody was supporting that group who fired and maybe even missed one ballistic missile, those people would be fired from their jobs. Those people would be definitely not being supported to protest in the street in support of that organization.
Yeah. So, you know, so you find out that Israel is indeed in the war that was thrust upon us. What was your first reaction? What did you do?
I mean, look, it's kind of a blur, the whole thing, right? In my head, I'm thinking, okay, this is like too crazy, right? But I guess the other thing in my head is, all right, how do I get back to Israel? And my friend and I, we end up going to his rabbi. We get like the rabbi gives us like a heter, like we can go and open our phones because it was still Shabbat. We technically can't unless it's to save somebody's life. And so we open our phones and 45 missed phone calls, my teammates talking about their friends who have been killed and their haven't been able to get into contact with certain people. Some of my friends already fighting in their communities because terrorists have overrun them. And you're talking about like this feeling of like, how is this happening? Like, this can't be real. Like, we're talking about my friends, my close friends currently fighting for their lives in their communities. And what I'd like to kind of ask the people watching this are, imagine your community and suddenly in your home, the safest place you should be able to be, there are terrorists outside and you're hiding in your bomb shelter, which should be the safest place in your home. And they are in your house shooting at your bomb shelter. Like, these are things that like normal people just cannot understand, that the reality of what was happening. It's different than, I mean, I'm not minimizing at all 9/11, right? Because obviously it was the most devastating thing to America probably since Pearl Harbor. But your home, the sanctuary of peace in your life, is being targeted by terrorists who have overrun your home and taken your parents, taken your children out and brought them back to enemy territory. And you are now tasked, you, your brother, your father, your uncle, are now tasked with saving every single person in the community from massacre, from rape. I can't even imagine the nightmare of what that means. Like, it's so viscerally scary. It's worse than anything I can even imagine. The weight of responsibility that I'm sure at the moment they weren't thinking about. But looking back on it, it's like, the only thing at this point, because the army hadn't gotten there yet, the only thing in between terrorists and my entire community is me, my dad, my brother, my uncle, and my best friend. I don't know how you reconcile that. I don't. And like, God bless all the people who are protecting these kibbutzim and the Otef. And unfortunately, we lost a lot of people. But I mean, it's unbelievable. And so my friend and I are saying, okay, we need to get back to Israel now. And obviously, there was an indication.
Let me stop you here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have to stop you. You just expressed this. Probably the clearest way to explain what was going on October 7th. The feeling that you have to protect your family. I've seen videos and interviews of people that are not fighters, like, and how they took like the biggest kitchen knife into the bomb shelter. Like, but then your reaction was, how do I go fly to Israel and join the fighting?
Yeah.
Where are your parents in all of this?
They don't know yet. They're in Queens right now, right?
Okay.
And I think, you know, when people have asked me like, why did you have to go back? Right? And what I always say is pretty simple. Right? My entire life, like I said to you before, I feel like I'm a born fighter. And I've always said that if I was living in the time of the Maccabees, I would have wanted to be a Maccabee, right? And if I was living in the time of the partisans who were fighting against the Nazis in the forests, I would have wanted to be one of the partisans. And if I was living in the time of the Irgun and Palmach and Etzel and Lehi, I would have wanted to be one of them. And so history in this moment gave me this unique opportunity and extended its hand to be one of the few fighting Jews in our 4,000-year history. Shai, what am I going to do? I'm not going to take that opportunity? How could I not? How could I not take advantage of an opportunity to protect my people when we've walked like sheep to the slaughter so many times? I refuse. I refuse. And so
I say, flew to Israel.
Yeah.
And make your way to Israel.
Yeah. So we get back, and I guess preceding that, the conversation with my parents, man.
Yes.
That was
what did they tell you when you said I'm going back? I think and I imagine, just knowing you very briefly, but knowing you, you weren't asking to go. You were telling them you're going. What was their reaction?
Look, I get home after the chag. My two friends drove me home. And I'm like already shaking walking into my house. And I remember opening the door. And by the way, like after Shabbat, after a chag, you know, my mom would always call me and say like, hey, like how was the holiday, whatever. No text, no call, obviously, because I think my parents knew just as well as I knew. And I get home, I open the door, and I lose it. Like I just sit down by the door and I'm just crying. And then I already see my family crying. Like they know I'm going. They know. And I'm the only boy in my family, right? I have two sisters and I'm the only one who was in the army. And you know, my family saying to me, obviously don't, like crying that they don't want me to go and that I'm too young to go and put myself at risk. I have so much ahead of me and whatever. And I think understandably so, right? Like they don't want me to go to an active war. I think my response to them, I don't exactly remember, was something along the lines of, but everybody else doesn't have a choice. So why should I? I don't have a choice. Right? We don't have a choice. We have to fight. They have women, they have kids, they have grandparents, they have Holocaust survivors. What choice do I have? What kind of hypocrite would I be if I sat at home and watched on the television as my friends are going to fight when they don't have a choice? And this is the fight of my life. Like I said before, people are probably known for one specific thing that they do in their lifetime. This is mine, and I would not be able to live with myself ever again. When my kids at my deathbed or my grandkids ask me, you know, Dad, Saba, what were you doing on October 7th? What did you do to protect Jews? And if I had to look them in the eye and tell them that I did nothing, that the things that I could have done compared to the things that I could have done, I would be ashamed. I had to fight.
I tell this to everyone. I tell them, this will be written in the history books. Your children and grandchildren will learn about this in history class, and they will ask you what you did in Israel, in the diaspora. We will ask you, what did you do when Hamas and Hezbollah came for the Jews in Israel, and that the Hamas and Hezbollah supporters came for the Jews outside of Israel? And the worst answer you can have, there's no wrong answer other than, I did nothing. So you spent 41 days in Gaza.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit more. By the end, it was about 2 months.
2 months.
Yeah.
What was it like? Again, you just got back from New York City. You have a job in finance. All of a sudden, you are in Khan Yunis. You're in Jabalia. What was it like?
I mean, like other than knowing that, you know, we're protecting Israel and feeling like we have a really important part of history right now. It sucked, right? It's not a fun place to be. And we know we're going to get ambushed. Every single time we see an enemy, we're going to get ambushed. They know that we're coming. They're waiting for us. And it's not fun. War is not fun. For anybody who thinks that we are enjoying ourselves being there, no. This is the worst thing that anybody could experience. And I mean, you watch movies, you see Saving Private Ryan, you see Fury, you see all these movies and you see like towns destroyed and all the rubble and all this stuff. It does look like that. And it's awful. It's really awful. And unfortunately, Hamas, I mean, in the end of the day, Hamas is to blame for this. We did not ask for this war. We did not want to be there. And something that I tell everybody is, on October 7th, you didn't just have the slaughter of 1,200 Israelis. You didn't just have the hostage taking of 251 hostages. You had Hamas, Iran, Hezbollah, PIJ signing the death certificate of every single Palestinian in their blood who have died as a result of this war. We did not have to have this war. These people did not have to die. And it's not Israel's fault, and it's not the Palestinians' fault. It is these people who have orchestrated this war, signed off on this war, funded this war, materially supported this war, who have forced these people to die.
But I do want to ask you, and it's important that someone was there we'll address this. I think a lot of times people say, what about civilian casualties? And I think we should be talking more about the civilian casualties, because civilian casualties, it doesn't matter if you're Israeli, Palestinian, it doesn't matter. It's horrible. Any death is one death
tragedy.
Too much. As a soldier who was there and you were with the soldiers there, did you ever think about the civilian Palestinians that are there? How do you deal with that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a great question. To your point, every single person who has died is a tragedy. Palestinian, Jewish, Israeli, I don't care who you are. It is a tragedy. And if you look at the numbers and what Israel has done and the efforts that Israel has gone to, the IDF, my team specifically, in escorting people to safety, our enemy civilians, we have escorted them to safety at the expense of our own lives. People saying that we're committing genocide. What genocide happens when the opposing army is bringing the innocent people to safety so that we don't get them in the way when we're targeting Hamas? Knowing that Hamas might be amongst the people who we're escorting, when we're sending these millions of messages and these leaflets and these phone calls, alerting people, we've taken over radios, like the entire radio system, to tell them, evacuate from this area, we are coming. What genocide is alerting people so that they don't get in the way? And it's really, really frustrating for me when people say that me, an IDF soldier who cares about humanity, who cares about lives, can look me in the eyes and tell me that I'm a baby killer. It is such an insult. Such an insult to the efforts that we've gone to protect people. Like I said to you before, I don't care if you're a Palestinian innocent civilian. I don't care if you're an Israeli innocent civilian. I will die for you if it means protecting you. It doesn't matter. These people don't deserve to be in this situation, but accountability has to be put on the people who are actually accountable. And it's like the classic situation, right? A bank robber comes into a bank and robs the bank at gunpoint, has hostages, and the police are outside trying to settle the score and try to stop the bank robber. In the efforts to rescue all the people, two of the hostages end up getting killed. Who are you blaming? Are you blaming the police or are you blaming the bank robber? It's very obvious who is at blame. It's so unfortunate.
Well, it's obvious to you. It's obvious to me. It's probably obvious to most, if not all, of the people listening or watching. Unfortunately, it's not obvious to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Which brings me to your next battlefield. You finish your 2 months in Gaza, and again, you come back to the United States. You have a job in finance. But then you throw yourself into the ideological battlefield,
yeah,
especially of U.S. campuses.
Yeah.
Walk me through that, because when I first met you, I didn't know that you served in Gaza. Hmm. And I thought, okay, here's another guy doing great Hasbara, but you didn't have to do the Hasbara. You didn't have to go and explain what's happening in U.S. colleges. You could have just said, I've done my bid. When I'm on my deathbed, my grandchildren will know that I went and I fought for Israel. Why now throw yourself into this other battlefield?
Yeah. And right before we get to that, I actually want to address something else that about Gaza, and then I'll go into that question. Yeah. It's important for people to understand what we are up against, right? You go into a house and in the area where we're taking over, whether it's in Sajaya or wherever it might be. And this is perhaps a normal person's house, right? You see stickers in a kid's bedroom of Mickey Mouse or whatever it might be. And then under their bed, you find an Uzi, or you find...
Uzi is a automatic rifle.
Okay. Or you're moving furniture around, like a big couch, and you hear something moving in the couch. You flip the couch over, you tear it open, and you find an RPG ready to go. This is what we're dealing with everywhere. Every single person's house that we went into, every single one, we found something, whether it is just a flag of Hamas or a manifesto of ISIS, or it's whatever it might be, we are finding things everywhere. And I'm not saying that there are no innocent civilians, because there are. There certainly are. But we have an obligation to defend our innocent civilians, just like every other country in the world will. And these people are hellbent to their death in trying to maim, injure, harm everyone. And that includes the Palestinians. And I think it's really important that people understand that Hamas is not a resistance group fighting on behalf of Palestinians. They're a group so selfishly trying to increase the amount of Palestinians who get killed in this conflict, because that is what garners international attention. And it's so tragic. So for people who are watching who don't understand what's going on, they need to really look at what is Hamas, what do they stand for, and why are they accountable for this? Because they are fully accountable for this. But to your question, for me, it felt a lot like, look, I just came back from this physical battlefield, and I felt it would be, once again, hypocritical of me to not do something that I can do. I know I can speak. I know that I have these firsthand experiences and accounts that most other people in the world do not have. And how can I not use my voice, right? If something that my rabbi told me that I thought was really, really special, he said, if God's plan for you wasn't that you would die al kiddush Hashem, right? It wasn't that you would die sanctifying God's name in battle. That means that you have to live al kiddush Hashem. That means you have to live sanctifying God's name. And that's not necessarily a religious thing, right? The way that I view that is, if the plan wasn't that I was supposed to die saving my people, that means that I have to live saving my people too. And that means doing whatever I can, trying to educate people on what's going on in the conflict, trying to show them that I am a human. I'm an IDF soldier and I will defend Israel to my dying breath, but I'm a human being. And so my three tenets have really just been, you know, empowering Jews in this time through the stories, through the miracles that happened to me during the war. Because I shouldn't be speaking to you right now, Shai. I mean, I should be dead. The amount of times that my team and I were ambushed and evaded rigged houses and all these things, I should not be alive. So if I'm here, it means I have to do something with it. So empowering Jews is one. The second is having dialogue for peace, right? Trying to speak to people and educate them on what's going on. But what I usually do when I speak, especially to somebody wearing a keffiyeh or a Muslim who's hurt, and they deserve to be hurt. This is a very, very difficult situation, but you have to show empathy, right? And so what I usually do is I say to them, listen, your Ibrahim is my Avraham. We share a grandfather. Let's have a conversation so that we could be caring grandchildren, so that your kids and my kids do not have to fight in the cycle of violence, because it's really only going to go one of two ways, right? It's either going to be another war and another war and another war and bloodshed and bloodshed and bloodshed for the next 100 years plus, or we actively decide on a civil solution here in which coexistence is the answer, where I can sit at a restaurant and you could sit at the same restaurant and we could play shashbash against each other instead of fighting against each other.
Backgammon.
Exactly. Same thing. And then my third tenet is something that I think I'm uniquely positioned to do, which is humanizing the IDF. Showing that we do care. We are only fighting for peace, just like any other country in the world would have the right to do under the same circumstances. We are not trying to hurt Palestinians. We are not here for nakama, for revenge. This is not about revenge. We are not trying to take over Gaza. We are not trying to obliterate people responsible for this. We are only trying to stop people who are supporting Hamas, who are Hamas, who want Israelis and Jews to be killed, because we have an obligation to do so. What country would accept 1,200 of their civilians being massacred and just sit on their hands and say, okay, yeah. What country would allow 251 of their civilians who are hostage, and still 100 of them who are hostage as we speak over 420 days later, and just sit on their hands and do nothing? No country in the world, Shai, no country in the world would accept that. And yet we're supposed to?
For sure. That's exactly, that's the crust, that's the core of the matter. That's the issue that we're dealing with, this double standard. And you've been one of the people going around and explaining this, telling people, showing people who we are, who you are. I've seen a video of you in I think it was Boise, Idaho, where someone asks a question from the audience, and you listen to the question very respectfully. And then you say something like, let me tell you the facts. And you go on like a 7-minute fact-focused, here are the numbers, here's what happens, here's the things. Do you think the facts matter? Do you think the facts actually change that person or other people's minds?
That person? No. And something that I've noticed is that generally when I have these conversations, whether it's on campuses or on the street, I'm generally not speaking to that individual. I'm speaking to them, yes. And I'm directed at them, yes. But when I'm speaking, I know that there's the 20 people around us listening. Or if it ends up becoming a clip, it's the people on social media who are listening. Because that person, they're probably already too far down the rabbit hole of misinformation. They don't care and they're not going to change their mind. Everything is confirmation bias for them. I need to target the people who are unsure and are saying, he brings up a good point. Maybe I should look into this a little bit more. Those are the people I'm targeting. Because I'm not going to get that guy. That guy in that video, he has probably seen the video. It has millions of views and he doesn't care. Right? He's not going to change his mind. Does truth matter? Today, it doesn't matter. Today, in our environment, I don't think that people value truth the way that truth once was valued. I'm hoping that in the future, whether it's in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in 100 years, that this idea of truth is something that is restored. That people actually do care and do look at facts and say, okay, this is objectively what is going on. Today, there's too many people who don't look holistically at, okay, what is going on? What is the context of what has happened? Why have this happened? People are too eager to just jump at, okay, it's an open air prison, but don't ask, well, when did that start? How did that start?
What
was Israel's justification for, exactly, why is it a prison? Or they'll say genocide, but then like you say, okay, well, what is it? What exactly is it a genocide, right? It's about intent, the intent to destroy a group of people. Well, if Israel has done all these things to prevent innocent civilians from being murdered, does that mean that their intent is not to destroy that group?
My point is actually like I completely agree with you. People don't know the words that they're using. They throw out the word like open air prison without even thinking about it, without even realizing that if it is an open air prison, then Egypt is the warden, just as Israel. Like they don't, but putting that aside, I always tell people, let's assume it's an open air prison. Let me go with you and say that yes, it is a prison. I disagree, but let's say it is. Let's say someone was wrongly imprisoned for 30 years in a prison in upstate New York. And not only that, let's say, like you claim, that that person has been tortured for 30 years in that prison. And that person is able to break out of that prison. And the first thing that person does is murder all the prison guards and the wardens.
And their kids.
Wait. And people say, I'm not for that, but I can understand. But then now let's say that that's not enough. And that person goes and murders every prison guard's parent and kidnaps their kids and rapes their daughters. Like, at what point will you say, you know what? Even someone who breaks out of a prison, which I don't buy even the argument that it is an open air prison. But let's say it is. Even someone who breaks out of a prison, you wouldn't stand with that.
100%. And Shai, the example that I try and give people to show them that double standard is as follows. I say, under that guise of moral authority that this person who has been wrongly imprisoned has, you are now supporting that the Jews who escaped the Holocaust, after 6 million of them, and it was a real genocide, in which gas chambers, crematorium, death marches, you are now supporting that they should have come back to Europe and massacred every German that they could see, every Pole they could find, and pretty much everybody in Europe. That is what you're saying. We have the right to do.
Which is of course, ludicrous. Not true.
And that never happened, by the way. Right? So,
I mean, you're saying that every Native American
has the right
has
to murder
the
Americans.
Moral right to murder every non-Native American.
It's unbelievable. Right?
Like that's what you're arguing.
Yeah.
By saying that, you know, the Native Americans were victims of actual genocide and ethnic cleansing by white Americans. That is recorded. But being the victim, having the status of victim, doesn't give you the moral authority to now be the victimizer.
Yeah. I also think it's super important for people to understand, like, okay, you want to call yourself a victim. And I guess we could get into what a victim actually is, but there has never been, ever, in history, a group of people who are victim of genocide who have received over 40 opportunities since said genocide has begun, brokered by third parties, that they could end the genocide today by releasing hostages and lowering their arms, and they said no. Show me another example in which did the Jews in the Holocaust ever get the opportunity for a ceasefire? Are you kidding? 40 opportunities. 40 opportunities has Hamas had to end this war. They have said no. This could have been over in October. This could have been over in November, December, January, all the way until now. We're now in 2020, almost in 2025. This did not have to happen. These people did not have to die. Hold the people accountable. Hold Hamas accountable. They are enslaving the Palestinian people. They are the enemy here. It's not Israel. It's not the Palestinians. It's Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, PIJ. They are responsible. And people don't understand.
I should say PIJ is Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Yeah.
And what people don't understand and they refuse to acknowledge is that these are US and EU designated terrorist organizations. This isn't like just some random group. These are legitimate terrorist organizations. And the fact that people can, and what people are kind of misguided in is that they think like, okay, Intifada Revolution is going to help the Palestinians. No, what happened on October 7th only hurts the Palestinians more, right? If you throw a rock at a hornet's nest, you might knock the nest down, but the hornets are going to come and get you. And you know who's going to get hurt by that? The innocent Palestinians. And if you think for a second that Hamas didn't know what was going to happen, you were sadly mistaken. They knew exactly what was going to happen. And they took that weight and said, we're willing to make the sacrifice. It's so sad.
I wish we had more time. Yeah, I want to talk a lot. I want to talk about the college experience, and I'll have you back again. I do, before we finish, I want to ask you what happened on CNN. The unaired Samfried.
Yeah. So as I was kind of doing a bunch of my speaking, somebody from CNN reached out to me and asked me, like a pretty known, well-known news anchor. I'm not going to say the name, but he reached out to me and said to me that I should come on and you know, have a chat with him. He wanted to interview an IDF soldier to see what my thoughts were on what was going on. This was back in probably April. So I had recently come back from the war. I came back in February.
April 2024.
Yes. I'm all excited. You know, a bunch of people were saying to me, this is not a good idea. You know, CNN is not on our side. They're going to try and connive and misuse your words. And I said, no, actually, this is a wonderful opportunity for me as a proud Jew to show the humanity of the IDF and to highlight our interest in peace and peace alone. And so I go on and I'm ready and I come prepared. And thank God that day I brought it, right? I am challenging this guy on everything that he says. Unfortunately, it wasn't live. I wish it was live, Shai. For instance, this guy he asks me all these different things about, you know, war crimes, etc. And he says to me, one of the things he says is, you know, as an American Jew, you're a US citizen, why did you have to go and fight in this war? Why did you have to go to Israel's war? And I said to him, well, beyond the fact that this isn't just like in Israel war, 46 US citizens were killed on October 7th, which makes it a US conflict as well. Beyond that, there are currently, at the time, there were eight US hostages who are literally in Hamas dungeon prisons as we speak underground. Can you name a single one of them? Crickets. And I say to
him, CNN anchor.
Yeah, yeah.
Name, and by the American way, American hostages.
He is one of the national security correspondents for CNN, one of the chief national security correspondents for CNN. And I say to him, shame on you. Shame on you that you can every single day post things on your Instagram and say things about Israel and dictate how Israel should do the war, but you can't name a single U.S. citizen who has been hostage in Gaza since the beginning of the war. How dare you?
How did he respond?
Jump to the next question. And I was like, man, you really... And so, lo and behold, I said to them at the end of the interview, I said, all I ask is that when you put this piece out, that you highlight that I was saying that we want peace, that we do not want anything besides peace. And they said to me, yeah, no, it's for the integrity of the story. Of course, we're going to give you a fair shake. I'm like, I don't care about a fair shake. Highlight the truth. And twisting my arm, they're saying, oh, we're going to put it probably at the end of this week. And I'm like, okay, cool. End of the week comes. Say to them, okay, well, what's the deal? They say, next week. Obviously, the next week comes and goes. I'm like, is there any update? Week after. A month goes by and they say, yeah, you know what? We're not going to use the piece. And it's so unfortunate because a news agency as big as CNN, who claims that it's about the integrity of the story, they have the opportunity to show both sides. They have the opportunity to have opposing views on, which shouldn't shake them completely to destruction. But just show the truth. Why would you want to, if I'm saying we want peace, what is it to CNN to not show that?
I'll tell you what, the truth doesn't sell ad space. The truth is not ratings, you know, and that's the math. Unfortunately, that's the math that too many of these media outlets are thinking. And I don't blame them. They have been conditioned to only think about money. And when you only think about money, truth comes second. Which is, by the way, one of the reasons why when we started this podcast, it was clear to me, no ads, right? If we get money, it's only from private donors, which, by the way, this season 3 is sponsored by, you know, thousands of people who just reached out and sent money, and I'm so grateful for them. Amazing. Once you get beholden to your ads and your sponsors and whatever, the truth doesn't, they don't care, even for a news agency like CNN.
Unbelievable. I don't know how much time we have left, but I guess I have a couple of, if there's room for a question.
I have to wrap it up.
Okay.
But let me give you one. Yeah. One thing you want to, and then I want to wrap it up. I wish we could.
Yeah, we could speak forever. Man, which question should we go with? I guess, how do you view Jewish leadership today? Where I guess there's no more Menachem Begins. There's no Natan Sharanskys who are our compass. Where do you see us going in terms of following either, is it a collective? Is it individuals? How should we go forward?
Wow, that's a great question, which I'd love to hear your views on this. My view is we have idolized people like Rabin, Menachem Begin, Herzl, like going back. And what we forget is all of them just started as regular people, teenagers, young Jews that just wanted to do something. We know the end result, right? We see, like, for example, Shimon Peres, right? He was the president of Israel, was, you know, prime minister, you know, love him, hate him, was a leader. My grandfather knew him as his madrich in Noar Oved.
Really?
When my grandfather was 16 and Shimon Peres was 18 or 19. Right, so you don't start as a leader. You just start as someone who starts doing whatever needs to be done. And if people follow you, then you become the leader. That's my view. But what is, you've been talking about this so much. What do you see?
I mean, no, I think what you're saying is really the correct thing, right? And it's that the people who we look up to are regular people. You, prior to October 7th, you were just me, just these regular people. Anybody has the opportunity to become a leader. And I think what's super important, and this is, I guess, how we could conclude, is that every single person today, you don't need to be a soldier. You don't need to be an influencer. You don't need to be on the ideological battlefield. But find the thing that you can lead in. Find your fight. Find the thing that you can do. I don't care if it's giving a cent to charity for supporting Israel, or it's going out and debating people in the street. I don't care if it's coming to a rally. I don't care if it's connecting to your Judaism or going to fight or volunteering for MADA or whatever it is. Find your fight. Lead something. Because in the end of the day, we have only been able to thrive because of people's contributions, individual contributions that as a collective have been able to, you know, reap what yield what we have. But we as a people are a people of leaders, and each individual has a responsibility to lead in their own way. So just find your fight.
Man, I wish we could end this here. Just drop the mic, because that is that is the whole point of this podcast. Yeah. But before we do, I want to finish off. Every episode I finish with what I've been calling the Jewish lightning round.
Cool.
Series of quick questions and answers. There's no right or wrong answers. You get one pass. I get to decide whether you get that pass. Mm. All right, Sam Fried, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Oh, man. I don't know. I am very emotional, and I struggle with everything going on a very emotional level. And I know people see like this strong guy outside fighting on the front lines, whether ideological or physically. It's very difficult. It's not easy.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
We are lovers. We are lovers of people, and we have just sought to make life better for everybody in the world. To be a light amongst the nations doesn't mean we lead the nations. It's to make life better for the nations through innovation, through leadership. We only want to help people.
What is your favorite curse?
Ay, shalmuta. Stop now.
I don't like that. Shalmuta, which is Arabic. When was the last time you cried?
Man, yesterday.
Wanna?
Just very overwhelming. Like everything going on. It's very, it's this whole situation. It really gets to me. Like I said, I'm an emotional person, and reflecting on things, writing things down. You know, you look back. I was in Gaza last year at this time, and I think back to a specific experience literally yesterday last year, and I'm very thankful to be alive, but so many people haven't been able to get out of those situations, and so yeah mortality.
Yeah. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
My dad's dad, my grandfather who fought in World War II on Omaha Beach. He is my compass. He is my hero. And maybe he didn't end up becoming prime minister or anything like that, but he is the person who I wish I could have met, and I never met him.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Listen, it's a weird one, but I guess it's the dichotomy between Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaTzmaut. I think it's really
Memorial
important.
Day and then
yeah,
Independence
exactly.
Day.
I guess it's not a Jewish holiday, but it's the Israeli holiday. I think it's really important to understand who has given what for us to be where we are, and for us to then go from the worst day. They follow each, right? So Yom HaTzmaut follows Yom HaZikaron. So you go from the saddest pit of sadness in Yom HaZikaron, and then the next day it's the biggest celebration. I think there's a really beautiful quote by 50 Cent, where he says, "What good is the sunshine without the rain? What good is the joy without the pain?" And I think that is the summary of that juxtaposition and that dichotomy between Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaTzmaut, where you really appreciate what we have.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Oof. Any holiday that lands a 3-day yontif or a 2-day or 3-day yontif in the middle of the week where I lose all my vacation days from work.
When do you feel safest?
Ironically, it's when I'm wearing my uniform and carrying my gun, knowing that even though I'm a target, I'm protecting people.
When do you feel least safe?
Ironically, when I'm in civilian clothing and when I can't protect people.
Right. What gives you hope?
This is a difficult one. I think what gives me hope is that I'm able to walk in the street today still wearing my kippah, and people will stop me and just fist pound me and say, like, kol kavod achi, or I go somewhere and people say to me, you know, your video inspired me to be a proud Jew. And I think so long as we have proud Jews who are willing to fight, whether it's you, I, anybody, we have that tikvah, right? Like I said to you before, it's not just an anthem. Yeah. It's a real an obligation.
Hope. What is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
Just the right to exist, the right to be a proud Jew without people hating us just for being. What is it? What do we have to do to prove our existence is not only rightful, but I mean, we've contributed so many things to society. You would think at this point that people would just be like, wow, you know what? Maybe we should just let them be. Maybe they'll do something good.
You'd think.
Yeah, right?
All right. Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week?
Oh, easy. The Shai Davidai podcast.
No, I'm kidding. I mean, yes, please send money to Here I Am with Shai Davidai. It's on GoFundMe, but
yeah,
that's not the most important thing.
There's a great organization called Nevut, N-E-V-U-T. And Nevut does a lot of good for lone soldiers specifically who have come back from the war. And there's many of them in the diaspora who they don't get, you know, help psychologically after the war. And it's kind of like, I would not be able to be where I am today speaking about these things and whatnot without Nevut's help. They help either financially, psychologically, with therapy. They do retreats for lone soldiers. And, you know, we're going through it and battling on a day-to-day. And to have an organization who supports us and is willing to, you know, put their time and energy into helping us be the best version of us that we could be after experiencing all the things that we did in the war, super, super important. So,
Nevut, yeah. N-E-V-U-T.
Correct.
Sam, where can people find you?
On Instagram, SamFried26. Fried is spelled F-R-I-E-D, for those who don't know. And just reach out. I'm always down to have a chat and happy to come to your community, speak, debate, whatever you want.
I'm definitely going to have you back because there's so much more of it I want to talk about. But I started this episode by referring to you as an everyday hero, and I want to conclude it by referring to you as an everyday hero. And I know it's not something you want to hear or like hearing, but the point that I want to make is you grew up in New York City. You went to enlist in the IDF. You came back to New York City. You then volunteered to fight on October 7th. Then you came back to New York City. You're doing this ideological battlefield in the U.S. And you still have a job in finance. It's not like you're showing people that everyone can do something. You don't have this to be your entire career as activism, but you have to do something. So I am so glad that we were able to organize this. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thank you
so much. You're off to work, I know, after this. But I'm very, very, very grateful to say, here I am with Sam Fried.
It's been an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Allah. Am Yisrael Chai.
Am Yisrael Chai.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."